You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And let me turn this on here. Oh, I turned that one off. And at the Koch retreat, top GOP Senate candidates credited the Koch network for their rise. That's the headline over at Huffington Post. They're quoting a piece in The Nation. And The Nation, I think, kind of buried the lead. Basically, Joni Ernst got up at a Koch brothers gig and said, basically, I wouldn't be here running for the Senate if it wasn't for you guys. You know, you billionaires making it all happen for us. Thanks so much. And she was not the only one. I mean, she's one of the more, you know, big names, but Freedom Partners and Americans for Prosperity, they talked about the Senate races that they were going to get. It's really astounding how blatant this is. And I think that, in a way, the strategy, you know, the right used to basically hide their donations. I mean, back 20 years ago or even 30 years ago in the 1980s, when Limbaugh was starting and the infrastructure was being built for the modern day conservative echo chamber, the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the group that checks media and you know, all these various organizations, the Federalist Society to make sure that you've got right-wing judges and right-wing lawyers and all these positions. And they, you know, they've taken over more than half the federal judiciary, including a good chunk of the Supreme Court. All of these things, as they were being done, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, they were like, you know, oh, yeah, we'll do this all under the radar screen. Progressives figured this was going on over the last 5-6 years, and really over the last 5 or 6 years, there has been an increase in progressive media. Everybody thought Air America was it. Air America was a good start, but, you know, there were a number of us who were on Air America. We're still around. Air America lost some stations, but, you know, Free Speech TV has picked up the slack. Sirius XM has a progressive channel. There are a number of Pacifica stations now that are carrying this program and others, and more importantly on the, or not necessarily more importantly, but I think, you know, with a larger total reach, it used to be that basically the news website that everybody went to was Drudge, which is, you know, a clear right-wing bias. And now we're seeing, instead of Drudge, we're seeing a variety of progressive media. You've got Common Dreams, Alternet, Raw Story, Truth Out, Op-Ed News, The Daily Banter, and sort of progressive media. The Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, The Daily Beast tries to be Time Magazine. Huffington Post is a little more corporate left. But, you know, the point is that we're speaking about this stuff, and now increasing numbers of Americans know that the Koch brothers, I mean, back in the day, it was Richard Mellon-Scaife and Joe Coors, right, 20, 30 years ago. And they were, and the Koch brothers. They've, you know, the Charles Koch Foundation got renamed as the Cato Institute. But they were funding stuff on the sly. The average person had no idea that there was basically this set of billionaires who were putting into place all the mechanisms necessary to control American governance. It was fairly clear, starting with the Reagan era, that there were large, powerful economic interests that were trying to control the economy of the United States. When Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982, you saw this explosion of merger and acquisition activity. By the time the first Bush administration, 1988 to 1992, you saw, you know, an explosion of, you know, the beginning of the whole Enron phenomena, which ran through the early Clinton administration, and Phil Graham's wife, Wendy Graham, deregulating the banks, deregulating commodities, and then Phil Graham introducing legislation in 1999 and 2000, Graham-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, that deregulated the banks. So everybody, you know, you could see that this massive consolidation of our economic infrastructure, the economy of the United States, was happening as a consequence of very, very large investments, at least very, very large for you and me, hundreds of millions of dollars, in aggregate billions, maybe tens of billions of dollars over a period of a generation, being put into place by people for whom hundreds of millions of dollars is chump change. Whether it was SCAIF or whether it was Coors or whether it was the Kochs or whether it was the Bradley Foundation, all these groups. Now people are starting to talk about it. Politico did an article, what, 5-6 months ago about how Limbaugh and Hannity and Mark Levin and all these guys are getting hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. I think, as I recall, in the case of Rush Limbaugh, it was $6-8 million a year that is being funneled to their Laura Ingraham, that is being funneled to their programs in the form of, quote, sponsorships, much of which ends up in the pockets of these hosts. They get huge speaking fees, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 to go out and give a speech. If they come out with a book, then, you know, one of these foundations will buy 10,000 copies of the book, instantly propelling it to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and then they hand them off to groups like WorldNet Daily to give away in subscription drives. There is this very, very well-funded right-wing infrastructure. Nothing like that exists on the left. There are some pale attempts, you know, the Bloomberg thing about guns, it's kind of a single-issue thing. You got this one Silicon Valley guy who's, you know, said he's going to commit $100 million to climate change. But it's nothing like taking over the entire Democratic Party, taking over most of the media in the United States, having massive and major influence. And the obvious reason why is because the people who are pushing this from the right are, you know, view it as an investment. You put $100 million into a right-wing infrastructure and into getting people like Joni Ernst elected and doing these Koch brothers retreats like they're reporting on over at Huffington Post and The Nation. And what do you get out of that? You put in $100 million, you get back $1 billion in tax cuts. Nobody since the Reagan tax cuts has been seriously talking about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. When Reagan came into office, the top tax rate on people like the Koch brothers was 74%. It's now 35%. Nobody is talking about reversing the Reagan tax cuts. This is how successful they've been. And what I find particularly interesting, and what we have to guard against, is that as these stories of this handful, the Shelley Adelsons of the world, this handful of billionaires buying our political process, as these stories propagate across the media, in many cases, what they do is they demoralize progressives. And they demoralize average American voters who now have discovered, thanks to the study out of Princeton a few months ago, that the bottom 90% of Americans want almost never happens, unless it happens by coincidence to coincide with what the top 10% want. That's the only time it happens, because the statistical probability of what the bottom 90% want being turned into legislation and passed as a law is equivalent to noise. In other words, it can't be measured, the impact of that desire. Whereas the impact of the desire of the top 10%, very likely their legislation will be passed. The top 0.1%, highly likely their legislation will be passed. So the danger here is that confronted with all of this reality, some people are just going to say, you know, it's a rigged game. Warren was right. So let's give it up. No, we have to double down.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We have to fight the power of organized money with the power of organized people. We have no choice. We've got to do it. Okay, so Bill O'Reilly says white privilege is a big lie. Right. No, I'm not making this up. This was yesterday on Fox News, Fox so-called News. And he said talking points does not he some you know he refers to himself in his segments in the third person. I think he you know it's the royal we, right? Sort of like my saying, you know, here on this show does not believe. Now, come on. Anyhow, he says, talking points does not believe in white privilege. American children must learn not only academics, but also civil behavior. Oh, black kids don't know how to be civil? Right from wrong. Oh, black kids don't know right from wrong? As well as how to speak properly. Oh, no more of that southern accent, huh? And how to act respectfully in public. Really, Bill? What is that? You know, are we back to the 90s and the boomboxes? Is that what you're, you know, you know, don't talk loudly. What was it when Bill went into that restaurant and people weren't shouting, you know, at the waitress? He was astounded, that Harlem restaurant. O'Reilly says, if African-American children do not learn these things, they will likely fail as adults. Well, you know, there is a kernel of truth to the suggestion that if you can speak white English and you do know how to behave yourself and you, you know, pay attention to academics and you know right from wrong, that you will do better, arguably, in this job market, at least in many places in the United States, particularly if you're trying to get a job in an area that's largely white. But that proves white privilege. That doesn't disprove white privilege. Because, Bill, you know, basically what you're saying is act like you're white. You know, and not even that. I mean, you're saying it in a way that's incredibly demeaning and assumes that the natural state of African Americans is not to be respectful, is not to know right from wrong, is not to engage in civil behavior. I mean, really? I don't even know where to begin with this. Every American has had to overcome, he says, in order to succeed in our competitive society, every American has to overcome the obstacles they face. And here is where the African-American leadership in America is failing. Instead of preaching a cultural revolution, the leadership provide excuses for failure. The race hustlers blame white privilege. Right. Bill O'Reilly is proving white privilege. And he's proving my statement. I know I had this conversation with an African American woman who called into the program last week, and I said, do you think that most white people know about white privilege? And she said, yeah, I think so. And I'm telling you, most white people have no idea what white privilege is. 75% of white people don't know a single black person. Now, white people are the numeric, you know, the overwhelming numeric majority in the United States. So that, you know, you can't necessarily attribute that to racism. You could attribute it to geography and demographics and actually you can attribute that to racism because you've got redlining, you've got this long history of keeping the races apart, and it's just echoing to today. But my point is that you know, the biggest part of white privilege, Bill, is never having to worry about your race. Is never having to think, you know, did I not get that job because of the way I talk or because of the way I look or because of the color of my skin? Was I judged on the external stuff instead of my intellect or my courage or my integrity? I mean, in a job interview, it's pretty damn hard to even, you know, share your integrity or your honesty. How do you do that? But then on top of that, you've got these horrible messages like O'Reilly's putting out that is essentially saying, African Americans are teaching their children not to be civil, not to behave, you know, right, not to know right from wrong, and not to act respectfully in public. And, you know, in both white and black society, there may be some parents who are so stretched out, or who are so dysfunctional, or who are, you know, working so many jobs, or, you know, single mom or dad at home, but also having to work a bunch of jobs. You know, the child care gets outsourced to somebody, or it doesn't even happen well. Absolutely, we've got people falling through the cracks. We should be dealing with that systemically rather than shaming and blaming those parents. These are symptoms of a system that has broken down as a consequence of racism and inequality. And we need to address both of them head on. Boy, there is so much going on right now. It's really worth talking about. We'll be back with more. Plus, it's Anything Goes Summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, what a day. Anyhow, Michael in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind? You called John Boehner's office, actually?
I'm sorry?
You called John Boehner's office?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about it.
I did on Monday. After watching some of the Sunday shows and talking about the lawsuit, I called up on Monday. And I was able to get through to a person. I called up several times before, and they put you on, you know, recording right. Or leave a voicemail and all. But I called, and I spoke to a young fellow there in the office, and I said, listen, number one, I'd like you to pass this along to the House leader there that this lawsuit is nothing but a distraction. Many Americans like myself that follow the news and follow politics, you know, see it as just a political ploy. You're always talking about the Democrats with their political ploys. Well, this is, to me, a naked political ploy. Well, what the attitude, first of all, this young man wasn't a people person. But in essence, just to encapsulate this, what he said was, well, basically, it's legal. This is well within the rules of the House of Representatives, Congress. It is extraordinary because of the extraordinary damage that this administration and this president have done and all. And he facetiously said, so you believe in royal edict saying that Obama, you know, with executive action is pronouncing royal edicts and all that. And I said, well, didn't George Bush do this? And he said, no, he was following what the Congress and the administration felt was it the will of the American people. And then and he said, it's legal. And I said, oh, so just like Citizens United is legal, right? And he kind of ha, 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 and he hung up.
Yeah.
That's the kind of attitude that you're met with when you call these people. This is not the first time I've called up a Republican, and certainly I'm not a Republican.
Yeah. Bottom line is, Michael, they don't give a rat's ass about your opinion or anybody's opinion. They are wholly owned by the Koch brothers and the other billionaires. They're going to dance to the tune of the billionaires and the big oil companies and the big cable companies and the big network television companies and the big ag companies and the big pharma companies, you name it, right? If there's a multi-billion dollar corporation or a billionaire in the picture, the Republican Party are there for them and not for the rest of us. Michael, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's a good one. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
You know, you're talking about white privilege.
Yeah.
I got a good example of white privilege. That little Texan over there that killed those five people while him and his drunken buddies stole the van and killed five people. He even killed one of his friends and severely injured the other one. Now, what was done to him? They sent him to California and some kind of a rehabilitation center. Never did any time. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't. I don't recall that, but these were all white people, right? Well, it's Laura Bush when she was 18 years old, running through a red light or a stop sign, apparently, and hitting the car driven by the boy that had just broken up with her and killing him. John Stewart gave the example, I think it was last night or the night before, of how they had dressed up, they had a white guy and a black guy going off to do an interview, just by coincidence. The black guy was the correspondent. He was wearing a suit, tailored suit, good-looking suit. The white guy was apparently the technician, and he was dressed like, John Stewart referred to it as homeless elf look, but, basically jeans and a hoodie kind of thing. And who did they stop going to the building? The black guy.
Yeah.
It's white privilege is alive and well in the United States. It's a cancer in this society, and we need to be talking about it. Donald, thank you for sharing your story. Beth in Paso Robles, California. Hey, Beth, you wanted to talk about white privilege?
Yes. Okay. So I was thinking earlier this morning when I was listening to your show, in the military, they want black women to change their hair to look more European. And
really?
If they don't, they get discharged.
Really? Black women have to straighten their hair?
Yeah, they either have to straighten it or they have to get, some type of a weave. And I'm a hairdresser, and chemical straighteners, I do black women's hair, too. And it's very toxic, and it's expensive, and it takes a long time to do. And weaves, hair extensions and weaves, it costs about $800 to over $1,000 to get. It takes 8 hours to put a weave in somebody's hair.
Well, and also those chemicals aren't good for you.
Exactly. That's why I just said they're toxic.
Yeah.
And another thing is my husband is black and I'm white. We live in a small area in California. We were looking for a place to live, and we were looking at this community that was a condominium but rental. Mm-hmm. They were pretty high class. Mm-hmm. Well, I asked if they had a 3-bedroom place there, and she said, "Oh yes, we have three bedrooms and one bedroom place." And I go, "Well, I need a 3-bedroom because we have 2 kids and they're boy and girl." So I went. My husband called them and talked to them. He was raised in Altadena, Los Angeles. He's a very educated, college educated man. So on the phone, he sounds white, and she's like, "Oh yeah, come on in, fill out an application. It's fine." Well, I go in there and I talk to her and I tell her that we called on the phone. And I was visiting with her, and then my husband comes in about 10 minutes later, and she says, "We absolutely have no 3-bedroom condominiums available, only the 1-bedroom, and it won't be available for 6 weeks.
As soon as she saw his black face, everything changed.
Exactly.
That's astounding.
Now, you could be educated, you could dress well, you could just be walking down the street, and a cop will stop you.
You can do all the things Bill O'Reilly said.
How you were raised or anything else. And you made a very excellent point, and I just started laughing on my way to work when you said Bill O'Reilly completely proves white privilege by his rhetoric on the news.
Right, because the biggest, and this is the other thing that white people don't get, is the biggest part of white privilege has nothing to do with black people. It has to do with the fact that white people never, during the course of their day, typically never think about their own race. They don't think about how their race is affecting people around them, unless they happen to live in largely African-American areas. They don't think about how their race is affecting other people around them, how it's affecting their interactions with their employers, how it's affecting their interaction with the credit card company on the phone, how it's, if they speak in a way that could identify them as an African-American, well, in this case, white people. I mean, white people just never even think about these things. And that is the, I don't want to say the coolest part, because that sounds like, oh boy, I'm proud of this. But that is like the nub of the most important part, the most powerful part of white privilege that every black person gets that, in my opinion, the vast majority of white people don't get. I'm assuming, Beth, since you're married to a black man, that you have friends who are both white and black. Would you agree with my assertion that most African Americans understand white privilege and most white people don't?
Absolutely. I talk about it to my clients sitting in my chair, and they just look at me and I could just hear crickets in the background because they think it's all about money. And I say, no, it's not about money. I could drive across the United States by myself and not be harassed. Do you think a black woman could drive from here across the United States by herself and be perfectly fine and not ever be harassed.
Right.
I don't have to think about it.
Right. Oprah Winfrey got stopped. She got stopped in a high-end. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to tell you one other quick thing. My husband is a truck driver. He works for North American Van Lines, his moving company. My son works with him, and he looked Hispanic because he's mixed. Well, a lady called the police at 12 o'clock midnight because they're still moving somebody from Arizona to Florida. Anyways, the people were already gone. The neighbor calls the police. The police come with their guns drawn. They have a big truck out front. They have North American Van Line T-shirts on. They come with their big, huge guns drawn at them, and their dogs clamp down on their crotches. They take him in anyways, even though he has all the paperwork, everything in his truck, took him in. They asked my son for his papers because he looks Mexican. He has to call me here in California so I can read him off his Social Security number and his birth certificate to prove that he is Kurt's son and be an American. And they let him walk home at 8 o'clock in the morning when it was already 90 degrees, you know, like 4 or 5 miles to get back to the truck. It was just, it's just an amazingly sick thing. And the fact that people, all it takes is just a slight bit of empathy and to open up your eyes and see past your own nose. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, I think that white people who grow up with little or no interaction with black communities or black people, which I'm guessing probably describes Bill O'Reilly quite well, genuinely don't get it. And I think O'Reilly, you know, it may be that he's trying to spread white racist propaganda, but I think it's more likely that he just doesn't understand what white privilege is. And he thinks he's got some simplistic answer, like, you know, just be a good person. Right. Beth, thank you for the call. And thank you for the real eye-opening, jaw-dropping stories. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out GreenWorldRising.org, our new website about the video about a carbon tax and how it can save the world. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, looks like we got a Fox News viewer on the line. Chuck from Flagstaff, Arizona. You wanted to talk about Warren Buffett?
No. First, thank you for taking my call, Mr. Hartman.
Sure.
I was just referencing a caller earlier that used the example of calling John Boehner's office.
Right.
And, you know, your statement was that the Republicans are tied to the
to billionaire donors, and they don't give a rat's ass about you. And I'd say that to you, too, Chuck.
And I don't disagree with that at all. I'm not arguing that point. My point is, what's different about the Republicans or about the Democrats? The Democrats are tied to Steyer's, Buffett's, Zorro's.
Please name for me one Democratic politician that Warren Buffett has supported.
Obama?
No.
Gave millions.
He did not make Obama's presidency possible. The fact of the matter is, what Buffett did is he came out and he said, I'm a billionaire and I pay lower taxes than my secretary does, and that's not right. And Obama proposed the Buffett rule. This is not the left-wing billionaires, and there's very few of them. George Soros doesn't fund individual political candidates. He funds Demos, and he's got a couple of things that have to do with, you know, good civil society. But these guys do not, by and large, engage themselves. Tom Steyer is not, you know, he will support a candidate who's in favor of climate change, but he's not going to own them wholly like the Koch brothers do. These guys support the Koch brothers are in the oil industry, so these guys support the oil industry. The Koch brothers are, you know, Georgia Pacific. They make paper, which is a very, very polluting and stinky process that the FDA regulates fairly heavily. So they're anti-FDA. They're denying that there's global warming. I mean, they want to keep taxes low on the billionaires. Then you get people like, you know, the multimillionaires for ethical government or whatever it's called. Nick Hanauer was on this program, and he said, you know, this is a guy. He was a billionaire. He was one of the early investors in Amazon, and he says, or maybe it was eBay, whatever it was, and he says, you know, you buy three or four pairs of pants a year. I buy three or four pairs of pants a year, five or six or whatever it is. He says, I make 10,000 times more than you do every hour, but I can't buy 10,000 pairs of pants. And so, you know, I mean, he'll lay out the issue about why it's appropriate, you know, that working people get paid well, that we need to raise the minimum wage and we need to extend unionization to people. But he's not buying candidates. You will not find that. The closest you can get to that is candidates who are supported by labor unions. And, you know, the argument has been made for years and years and years, well, for half a century, or a little more than half a century, by the Republicans, that the labor unions basically, because of their support, there are Democratic candidates who are in the pocket of the labor unions. And that may well be true. But you keep in mind, labor unions are democratic institutions. If 51% of the people in the union, a majority of the people in the union, do not want to support a particular candidate, it doesn't happen. So whereas with a corporation, the CEO or with a billionaire, you know, one person can make that decision. And to hell with what the workers want. You know, the CEO may have to answer to the 8 people on his board, but odds are they're all billionaires, too. I mean, go to theyrule.net and look at the interlocking boards of all these big corporations in America. Chuck, you cannot name a politician who is owned by a wealthy left winger. There's not one out there.
Well, I gave you one, and that was Buffett. The other one.
But Buffett isn't buying Steyer politicians.
Okay. Steyer owns Pelosi, both her and her.
Nancy Pelosi was around a long time before Tom Steyer came on the scene.
No. Everything that the Pelosis have, Mrs. Pelosi and her husband, is due to Steyer's backing. You know, all of the real estate holdings that they hold, all the stock that they hold in all these transit companies there in the Bay Area, they all are financed by Tom Steyer.
I'm not buying it.
Okay, say even though you don't buy it, okay? Hey, the way politicians are...
Pelosi has been in politics since Tom Steyer was 16 years old.
Okay. Today, the way we elect our government officials, it takes millions and millions of dollars.
Because the Supreme Court intentionally corrupted our political system, yes.
Okay. Agree. But, the problem that I have is... You know, both Republicans and Democrats, they're all the same.
No, they're not.
All corrupt.
They are absolutely not. The Democratic Progressive Caucus, which is the largest caucus in Congress, these are people who are not owned by anybody. By and large, they tend to be in safe Democratic seats.
Come on.
Chuck,
naive.
Chuck, obviously you have not read the budget proposal that they put forward. You haven't looked at the legislation they're doing. You know, you and I can agree that this system is screwed up, and it's been screwed up by five right-wing justices on the Supreme Court ever since 1976 with the Buckley case. But, the simple fact of the matter is, Chuck, that when money invests in politicians, typically it does it to make more money. It doesn't do it to make for a better society. And that's why the vast majority of the politicians who are bought and sold, the Scott Walkers of the world, who are bought and sold by individual billionaires or small groups of billionaires like the Koch brothers, they're the ones who are making life easier and better for the billionaires and harder and more grueling for middle class workers.
The bottom line is it's a corrupt system that we currently have.
I don't disagree with that.
But no one is willing to do anything about it.
That's not true. The Move to Amend has gotten over 500 communities now to pass resolutions saying we need to amend the Constitution to strip out this law that was created unconstitutionally, by the way. There's no power given to the Supreme Court under Article 3, Section 2. In fact, the opposite says that Congress shall operate under the exceptions provided by Congress and under rules established by Congress. The Supreme Court has come up with these doctrines, these twin doctrines, that money is somehow found in the First Amendment. The word is not there. You will not find it. And that corporations are somehow found in the 14th Amendment. And that absolutely was not the intent of the authors of either one. Chuck, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on One Call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Todd Gazziano, Executive Director of the Pacific Legal Foundation's Washington, D.C. Center, and the PLF, Pacific Legal Foundation, Senior Fellow for Constitutional Law.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, thank you for joining us. The website is pacificlegal.org/DC-center, and your tweets are Todd Gazziano, G-A-Z-I-A-N-O, and at Pacific Legal, just FYI. And we'll have all that stuff on our website. So, Todd, you wrote this piece basically saying that Obama is corrupting the legal process and trying to basically make laws. And apropos of that, New York Times today, I'm sure you've seen the article. The headline is Obama pursuing climate accord in lieu of treaty. Treaties require two-thirds of the Senate to pass. The first sentence, Coral Davenport wrote this. The Obama administration is working to forge a sweeping international climate change agreement to compel nations to cut their planet-warming fossil fuel emissions, but without ratification from Congress. So is this the sort of thing that you're upset about?
Well, that sounds suspicious to me, but I haven't had a chance to study it. And the devil is always in the details. Sometimes the president does have authority, and I would defend this president's authority or any president's authority to engage in some executive agreements that don't require ratification. So I'm not – it sounds suspicious to me, this one, but I'm not prepared to talk about that. But the best example, I think, is the president's executive amnesty for the children. I think most of us have sympathy for those children. And the president first said he didn't have authority to take unilateral action and that it would disrupt the legislative process if he tried to do so. But then when Senator Rubio's bill began to catch steam, he switched course and he took action, I think, to thwart the legislative solution.
Had I known you were going to go there, I had this last week. It's somewhere in that stack. The White House counsel's specific opinion was that there is no way, given the budget that you have, that you can enforce all of the immigration laws on the books. So it's entirely appropriate that you pick and choose what are the most important and take the ones that are the least important and form policies within the administration to not enforce those that are the least important. This is specific to the immigration law. That White House counsel's opinion was written by the during the Jerry Ford administration. This has been the policy of executive branch offices, literally since the Ford administration. It had been in the policy long before that. You can go back to the Bracero program with the Eisenhower administration.
As a general matter, I was a presidential legal advisor in the Office of Legal Counsel, which advised the White House Counsel, and by the way, in three different administrations, including the Clinton administration. So as a general matter, presidents have discretion. And as
a specific matter, they do.
Yes, but the devil is in the detail. But discretion only goes so far.
You know, if you want to make a case that this president has exceeded his authority in a way that is clearly unconstitutional, according to the Congressional Research Service, I believe it is, the one example that you actually could use is Bo Bergdahl. They've come out and said that that prisoner swap was unconstitutional because it was a clear defiance of laws passed by Congress that said no dollars appropriated by this Congress in any form under any rubric shall be used to release people from Guantanamo. I mean, you know, arguably what he should have done was the same thing Kennedy did when he ransomed those Guantanamo Bay prisoners out of Cuba from Fidel Castro. Congress did not give him the authority to do that. Congress was unwilling to give him the authority to do that. He was facing some really, really serious opposition that was being led by Richard Nixon, who wasn't even in office, but was getting ready to run in 64. And so what he did was, you know, they held that big fundraiser down in the Orange Bowl, and Jack and Bobby welcomed, all these guys, Harry and Ricky Ruiz Williams, and I'm forgetting all the names now, but, you know, the leaders of the movement. And then they went out to rich people, and they raised $1 million, and they gave that $1 million to Castro, and Castro gave us the hostages.
The Bergdahl exchange itself, I actually disagree with the Congressional Research Service. I think it's a closer case. I think what Kennedy did with the private money violates the Anti-Deficiency Act. So that was more questionable. But the best example, the reason I'm going to just try to simplify things with the executive action is the president himself said he didn't have the authority that he needed in the DREAM Act. And he predicted that if he interfered, it would disrupt the legislative process. So he knew what he was doing when he did disrupt the legislative process.
But he didn't disrupt the legislative process. The legislative process was disrupted by a group of 14 Republican members of Congress who got together the night that Obama was being sworn in 2009 in the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you know about this. Robert Draper's written about it in his book. Here's a summary of it if you want it. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, P. Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle.
But in June of 2012,
Pete Sessions said, we are going to become the Taliban insurgency. And Kevin McCarthy said, we are going to challenge them on every single bill.
That was their wish. But the fact,
that's what they did.
Let's go back to the facts of the executive amnesty. In September 2011, which is... the president says, I don't have this authority, and if I were to try, it would disrupt the process. In June, sure, there are people who try to disrupt the process. Marco Rubio's bill, bipartisan bill, was gaining a lot of traction.
Right.
And so without, I think, an adequate justification, and I could also tell you why I think, some of the acts, like the two-year renewable work permits, clearly go beyond discretion not to enforce. It's
establishing a system to not enforce.
And giving work permits
that
aren't authorized, that the president isn't authorized. But when he acted in June, he knew what he was doing. Those children need a permanent solution. Those children, I think we all think, and what the president did doesn't give them the next president, if it's Ted Cruz, can repeal that and only work on border security.
But Marco Rubio's legislation passed the Senate. It passed the Senate. It passed the Senate with bipartisan support. It went to the House of Representatives, and we know. I mean, this is – I'm sure you're not going to dispute this. If John Boehner put it on the floor for a vote, it would pass the House and it would become law.
And pressure was mounting to happen.
Why are you not calling for the impeachment or imprisonment of John Boehner rather than Barack Obama? Obama's simply reacting to the fact that Boehner – is part of this caucus room conspiracy to destroy this president's legacy.
What Obama was doing was trying to prevent permanent legislation that really would have helped these kids if it had Rubio's name on it. So that's what he.
Obama's trying to prevent it? No, it's Boehner is preventing it.
He said in September of 2011 that if he acts, it would disrupt the compromises that were necessary, and it did. Once he acted, then the incentives for compromise in Congress ceased to exist.
There were no incentives. He had 74 legislative days. From the time Al Franken was sworn in until the time Scott Brown was sworn in 2009, he had 74 legislative days where he could get things done. And he did. He got a lot done. Since that, everything has been filibustered. Absolutely everything. I mean, it's mind-boggling. You go through... I've lost my list.
Well, we can all admire some things the president has done and not done. But the other point is that a lot of his actions are unconstitutional.
So what's the remedy?
Like the recess appointment.
So what's the remedy?
Well,
the recess appointments have been rolled back.
The remedy that I'm calling for is for citizens to speak out forcefully. This is a nonpartisan issue because we, as Justice Brandeis pointed out, we should be especially wary when a president abuses authority for expedient
purposes. James Madison pointed
that out. Of course. A lot of smart people pointed that out. Because if we...
But shouldn't we be equally wary when Congress refuses to do their job simply because they want to destroy a political party?
Oh, we can throw the bums out. We can bring political pressure on members of Congress.
You can't throw the bums out when they've gerrymandered their congressional districts to the point where Democrats get 5 million more votes than Republicans in the House, and yet Republicans continue to control the House.
The House was controlled in my lifetime a lot more by Democrats than Republicans, and gerrymandering has been part of the process. The Supreme Court may...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Todd Gaziano, Executive Director of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. I'll leave you with the last word. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you very much.
In fact, I had... welcome back, by the way, your media support group for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. I had printed out this story from the New York Times, Carol Davenport's story, Obama pursuing climate accord in lieu of treaty. Because I thought, hey, this is something to talk about today. That we've got this. The UN meeting is going to happen next year in Paris, next spring in Paris, and it's a big deal. And because the oil industry owns people like Tom Coburn, owns people like Mitch McConnell, owns. Basically, the oil industry owns the Republican Party, the majority of the Republican Party. Every single Republican freshman member of Congress, every single member who was elected in the last election, has said on the record that global warming does not exist, or if it does, it's not caused by human activity. Which is, it's not even the official position of the fossil fuel industry. They're not stupid enough to say that out loud. Instead, what they do is they hire people to say it for them. People like Tom Coburn. And, it's really pretty astounding that the president, he's not even going to try. I mean, why bother? The Republicans control the House of Representatives. They won't bring to a vote their own. I mean, this is Marco Rubio's signature piece of legislation. Comprehensive immigration reform came out of the Senate, was passed by the Senate, went to the House, and John Boehner will not even bring it up for a vote. Instead, he has his mechanical monkey clapping its hands. That's it. That's what you get from John Boehner. Mechanical monkey. Long-term unemployment benefits. We're up to now 4 million Americans, which means now that's million American workers. Every worker who is supporting a household, the average American household is what, 2.3 people, I think, or 2.2. It's been declining somewhat over the last few decades, although it's starting to inch back up again. But my point is, if you've got 4 million people who have lost their long-term unemployment benefits, that's not just 4 million. That's 4 million families that are being wiped out. That's 8, 10, 12 million Americans. We have 12 million Americans who are living on less than $2 a day, according to the Financial Times yesterday. And the Senate passed, under control of the Democrats with Harry Reid, the Senate passed a bill that would have extended long-term unemployment benefits for 5 months from December to May. It is now August. That bill was passed back in March, maybe February. And those people still got nothing. Bubkis. many of those people might be some of you listening. People losing their homes, people whose families are breaking up. The number one stressor for families, the number one cause of divorce in the United States is economic. It's one of the reasons why the United States has a higher divorce rate than pretty much any other developed country in the world. Because we have more stressors on marriages. People can't afford to have, you know, they can't afford to live. Wages have been absolutely flat since Ronald Reagan took office, and they've actually declined since George Bush took office. Individual wages. Household income has gone up somewhat, but the reason why is because mom went to work, and then dad took a second job, and then mom took a second job, and then, you know, oldest kid went to work, and now you've got households where you've got literally two, three, four people contributing to the cost of the household. Whereas when Reagan came into office, the vast majority of households in America had a single breadwinner. So if you look at household income, yeah, household income has gone up since Reagan came into office. But if you look at individual wages, flat. Now, during that same period of time, productivity has increased over 100%. Profits have gone up dramatically. We're at the highest level of corporate profits in the history of the United States. We've even beat 1929. The highest level of corporate profit in the history of the United States. Our CEOs are making more money than any other time in history and than any other country in the world. The rich are doing really well. The top 1/100th of 1%, spectacularly well. 273% increase in wealth since the Bush administration. Just since Bush was inaugurated in 2000. The 1/10th of 1% doing really well. The 1% doing really well. Even the top 5% are doing okay. But the bottom 90%? Well, I mean, you know, you've got 80 people in the world who own more wealth than the bottom 60% of the entire planet. In the United States, you've got 400 people who own more than the bottom half of all the people in the United States. I mean, we have massive wealth inequality in this country. And it's not because Bill Gates is smarter than anybody else. It's because Bill Gates is using government welfare, the copyright laws, the trademark laws, the patent laws. They get extended over and over and longer when Disney goes out and buys politicians. Because, you know, his copyright was about to expire and go into the public domain. We can't have that. Walt Disney's been dead forever. Doesn't matter. The biggest corporate welfare programs in this country are the patent and trademark laws, and they stifle innovation and they make billionaires. It is an entirely rigged system. And since the 70s, when Lewis Powell encouraged his friend Eugene Sindor, who was the CEO or the chairman of the board or whatever he was, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in the famous Powell memo, and I write the whole history of this thing in my book, The Crash of 2016, lay it right out, in fact, quote extensively from it. Roger Ailes was trying to talk the Nixon administration into doing GOP TV. He finally founded, a sugar daddy and over at Fox. I mean, it's...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's time to seriously consider making some serious changes in these systems. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, it is anything goes summer. So, Antonio, listening on TuneIn Radio. Hey, Antonio, what's up? In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Tom, how's it going?
Just great. You want to talk about NASCAR?
Yeah. It's kind of odd because last Friday when I was listening, you want to actually call in and talk about white privilege and, you know, the struggle of people to see this. And so I was in NASCAR for about 8, almost 9 years. And I know being a black guy in NASCAR is kind of odd anyway in the first place. But
you're a black guy?
Yes, I'm black.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I was introduced to NASCAR through a friend of a friend, and he introduced me to a coach on a prominent team. And this coach took it upon himself, and he said he would train me to be a jackman. And I don't know if you know anything about NASCAR, but what they say is that jackmen are like the quarterback of the team. You know, it starts with the jackman and it ends with the jackman.
So is the jackman kind of like the team leader or the you know, how does it work?
Well, see, the jackman jumps off the wall. He's typically the first one off the wall. And when I come off the wall, I'm the one that jacks the car up.
Ah.
On the right-hand side. And without me being able to jack the car up, none of the other guys, the tire changer or the tire carrier, can do their job.
Right.
So this is why they say this is the quarterback of the team.
Sure.
And so it ends after I look at the tire carrier and changer. If they're done with their job, then I drop the car down, and then the driver takes off.
Right.
So being in a sport that's overly consumed with Caucasian males, my coach told me that I would struggle. And it's not because you don't have the talent. It's not because you don't have the build. It's because you're a black man in a predominantly white sport. So you have to work three times as hard. You can't just be as good as the next jack man. You have to be three times better.
You're Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I never understood that until later on in my career. And I got with a great prominent team. We won tons of races this year, that year. And, like, even races that we would win, I had a coach that would criticize me for the things that I've done. And we would only compete with one other team on pit road, and that was one of our teammates. So we were constantly going back and forth with our teammates, beating one another off pit road.
Yeah.
And so my coach, even though we won the race, would find something to criticize me about.
Yeah.
And I would watch the other guys, and we would all watch film together. And the other guys may have dropped the jack while they were trying to put the tires on or something, or they maybe dropped the jack too early, tire changer didn't get all the nug nugs tight. And he wouldn't say anything.
Right. It's like blame it on the black guy. You know, what's interesting to me, Antonio, and I'd love to get your take on this, is we had this conversation last week, and I asked people to call in and tell stories about white privilege. And nobody really told a story about white privilege. Instead, I had African-Americans calling in talking about discrimination, about, you know, being on the other side of white privilege, which is essentially what you're talking about. My guess is that the reason why I didn't have white people calling in saying, you know, I got a job last week and, you know, I think I got it because I'm white, you know, because it's a mostly white organization and they, you know, or whatever. You know, the reason I didn't get stories from about white privilege from white people is, like I keep saying, most white people don't even understand this. I'm guessing that coach who was criticizing you was not sitting there thinking, I'm going to pick on the black guy. It's just, It's like fish in water. They don't know that they're in the water. It's like the air we breathe. We don't view the air as a thing, you know, until somebody puts their hand over our mouth and nose. And right. Am I making sense here? I don't think I'm ever going to be able to do a show on white privilege where white people call up and say, let me give you an example of my white privilege.
I don't know if this is going to happen. I will say I did have couple of tire changes that I befriended, and they knew that they were there because of their ethnicity. And like I was saying in NASCAR, there wasn't possible for me. I had to do so much to get a tryout.
Right.
When somebody else could just say, I know, or I talked to such and such.
Right.
And I can literally, one other example real quickly. I knew this coach, and we would see each other at the track all the time. And I would ask him. I knew he had his position open. I would ask him. I was like, I just want to try out. That's all I want. You don't have to promise me anything. I just want to try out. This happened for about 8 months. And one other guy got fired from another team because he messed up. And that other guy, they got fired from the other team, got the job that I wanted when I kept harassing this pit crew coach about the job.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I was like, well, why didn't I just get one tryout? He's like, well, I knew him from before.
Now, see, that goes to the issue of not just white privilege, but also it's not quite class privilege. It's like there was an interesting study that came out this week, actually. It's in, I think I saw it over on Alternet. In fact, I think Lynn Stuart Paramore was writing about it, about how even though we've had over 30 years all these programs to encourage elite colleges, you know, the Yales and Harvards of the world, to bring in poor people, you know, regardless of race, to open the doors to poor people. It's not happening. The numbers are the same as they were 30 years ago. And what happens when you go to a school like Harvard or Yale is not that you get a better education. In fact, there's a fair amount of empirical evidence that you don't get a worse education than going to schools that have less prestige. But what you do get is you get access to the network. You get your roommate's dad is the CEO of a company, or your best friend's father or mother, you know, is on the board of directors of another organization. You know, it's the old cliche is it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I got to tell you, look around in any business, and you will find that some significant percentage of the people who are there were hired not because they showed up for a job interview, but because, you know, a friend of a friend got them in the door. And as long as our friend networks tend to be segregated, and there was another study that was published that I saw yesterday. I don't know when it was published, but it showed that the average white person has one basically black friend, which is the old joke Chris Rock used to make, whereas the average black person has on average 8 white friends. Now, the fact of the matter is there's roughly 7 times more white people than black people, so those numbers actually make a certain amount of sense. But the fact is that people tend to hang out with their own race. Back to you.
Right. And that's definitely true. You know, with us being at the track, and like I say, everybody that was black knew each other. There were so few.
Yeah.
And so we would hang out one another at the track, but we would try to integrate ourselves with, you know, definitely other people, because we knew that it just couldn't be, you know, us hanging around one another.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of funny that the looks that you would get and the stares that you would get from people and the attitude that you would get from people.
Well, and I would guess women in NASCAR would do the same thing. I would guess that in some environments, Muslims or Jews or, you know, any other, you know, relatively or even moderately identifiable minority might do the same thing. This is human nature.
And I would agree. And that's exactly how it
works. The unfortunate thing is when human nature then works to create a wall to, you know, a barrier to entry to people who are absolutely well qualified, but they're just not part of the network of what we used to refer to as the old boy network, but it's much more pervasive and it's much more subtle and it's much more insidious than that. And you know, it's only now that you know, after basically 60 years since the Civil Rights Acts and things like that, and also the women's movement, that women are starting to develop their own networks, that African Americans are starting to develop their own networks that can take them all the way to a position like President of the United States, and you know, it takes time, but we can't ignore the barrier to that network, which is in essence white privilege.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I definitely agree. And
yeah.
It's kind of, well, it's not really shocking, but I think just Bill O'Reilly doesn't want to admit it. You know, most people like yourself can see it and try to understand it.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't want to.
Yeah, but for Bill O'Reilly to run around and say there's no such thing as white privilege, I don't believe in this. It's just all because their parent, you know, because black people's parents don't teach them, you know, how to be good citizens. I mean, what kind of crap is that? I don't know how to say it.
I don't understand it.
Yeah,
I really don't understand it.
I don't either. It betrays either a fundamentally ignorant or a fundamentally racist worldview. Can you imagine if Bill O'Reilly went on television and said Jewish parents don't inculcate their kids with American values, the uproar that there would be, or or white Lutheran, you know, Catholics. Oh my God! Well, of course he is a Catholic. He wouldn't attack the Catholics. Baptists. I mean, you know, pick a group. It's just, but for some reason on Fox News, attributing these negative characteristics to African American parents is just fun. Antonio, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. Sounds like a fascinating life you've lived. I appreciate you listening to the program and calling. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Saturday right here on the Tom Hartman program in just a few minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Want to know how to stop the sixth great extinction? Go to GreenWorldRising.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joey in Charlotte, North Carolina. You want to talk about Mike Brown?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm well, Joey. How about you?
Tom, I'm doing fine. I'm a fan of yours, and I used to hate you. Not in a bad way. I was born in West Africa. My parents moved to Charlotte, North Carolina when I was a kid, and my dad got hooked onto you years ago, and mm-hmm. would be riding around, and you'll have this guy called Tom Hartman playing, you know, and I'm a teenager, and I'm thinking to myself, what in the hell is a Tom Hartman? My dad's got to be the dumbest guy on the face of the earth, and here I am about 15 years later, and I can't get enough of Tom Hartman. So I guess my kids must think I'm just as dumb as my old man was, you know, but I'm a big fan of yours. I just thought I'd say that first.
Thank you, Joey. I hope I'm as dumb as my old man was. I think we both probably had pretty good fathers. What's on your mind?
Yeah, he's a great guy. Well, I was just wanting to talk about the situation in Missouri. You know, I notice every time these tragedies happen, the right wing in this country will always try to bring out an equivalency to say, like, oh, wait a minute, how about the crime in the black neighborhood? What are you guys going to do about the crime in the black neighborhood? And I was telling my neighbor, John, who happened to be like a teabagging nut, and I told him, I said, John, why is it that every time these situations happen, crimes in the black neighborhood get committed by black people? White people kill white people. How come we never say, what about the crime in the white neighborhood? Latinos kill Latinos. People kill people that they are closest related to or of the same geographic situation.
Right.
But I think, like I was telling your friend, I said, it's like the old switcheroo.
Yeah.
You know, instead of focusing on what the problem is that is actually violent, you switch it around and say, let's talk about black crime. There's white crime. You know, I was telling my neighbor, I said, you never, you know, watch the 11 o'clock news and say, oh, God, three kids were shot in this trailer park today. It's always let's print an African-American situation in the front. And then we say, you know, I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah.
It's crazy, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. And let me add some texture to that, Joey. During the Reagan campaign, Lee Atwater I'm forgetting his name now, but the guy who helped found ALEC, who said, I don't want everybody to vote, Paul Weyrich. These guys pretty much made the decision to play the race card in a big way. It's why the first speech that Ronald Reagan gave as a candidate, as an official Republican candidate for president of the United States in 1980, was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where, you know, the three civil rights workers were brutally murdered back in the 60s. And his speech was all about states' rights, which, of course, is code for, you know, the federal government shouldn't be interfering in the segregation of our lunch counters. And the meme, the two big stories that the Reagan campaign used, and I'm old enough to remember this, but this is also, you know, there's numerous history books about this. The two main themes that the Reagan campaign used in the 1980 election were, number one, the welfare queen. In other words, a black woman who drives a Cadillac and goes and picks up 10 or 15 welfare checks under different names and, you know, commits fraud. And the New York Times said to the Reagan campaign, can you find this person for us? And they were unable for 8 years. The Times, the administration never produced such a person. The Times was unable to find such a person. Didn't exist, but it lives on in the minds of mostly white people. And that was the first. And the second was, quote, black-on-black crime, end quote, as if to say, A, most of the crime in the United States is happening in black neighborhoods, and B, this is proof somehow for the white people that the black people are so different from us. They've got a different culture. They've got a different way of living. They're all criminals. They're, you know, and therefore, you know, and the subtext of all of this was economic. Therefore, we need to cut programs that are helping bring people out of poverty. And in fact, if you could pull up, Shane, if you can pull up that Lee Atwater clip, I will put a punctuation mark on this. The whole goal was to cut taxes on white billionaires, and because those taxes were in part paying for people of color, but also white people. I mean, there were more poor white people in this country than there are poor black people. There were then, there are now. But what Reagan got and what Lee Atwater got was that if you talk about poverty, white people hear that as black poverty. Here's Lee Atwater talking about how we used to use the N-word. Now we just talk about taxes. White people still know it's a dog whistle about black people. Here's Lee Atwater in 1980.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968, you can't say that hurts or backfires, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get it so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And a hell of a lot more abstract than, you know. Anyway you look at it, race is coming on the back burner.
Yeah, and it's a hell of a lot more abstract than sitting around saying N-word, N-word, N-word. But, you know, it's the same thing that's going on.
The sad thing is, Tom, I find that amazing. Maybe it's because I was born in another country, or maybe I grew up in a third world country. But growing up in Liberia, West Africa, we was always told, because Liberia, in essence, used to be a former American colony.
It was.
And I said Liberia, and in essence, used to be like almost kind of like an American colony. The U.S. dollar was like the money that people...
Well, it was started by President James Monroe, actually.
That's right, when he sent free slaves back to...
That's right.
To Africa. But the sad thing, Tom, that, you know, we all grew up in Africa, especially in Liberia, you know, believing that America was like, the people in America were just so smart. Americans were some of the smartest people on the face of the planet. And just living in the South, I'm starting to realize that people vote against, I mean, I look at these guys, guys working at Walmart, and they vote against union, or they hate union.
It's right.
People, especially watching this stuff.
Yeah, we're not as smart as we think we are, Joe. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Or the billionaires are really good at fooling us. Or both. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, big happenings everywhere from Argentina to the Gulf of Mexico, and Greg Palast is all over all of them. The investigative reporter with the BBC and the News and the Guardian, the author of his numerous books, his most recent Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, his new film Vultures and Vote Rustlers is now available on DVD. You can find all this stuff over at GregPalast.com. And Greg, hey, my friend, it's great to have you back on the program with us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Before we get to the topic of your latest piece that you set out about how Katrina really happened because of the oil companies, I want to get into that. But first, the last time I talked with you, I think it was on the TV show a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about Paul Singer, the quote, the vulture, and the Argentinian bonds. Have you seen the ads that are running here in the D.C. market, like every 15 minutes?
Yeah, they're complete, for those who know finance, they're complete nonsense, fabrication, laughably ridiculous. What's going on here in a nutshell is we've got a guy called Paul the Vulture Singer, the most, by the way, not incidentally, the most important influential donor to the Republican Party. So the GOP's money bank. Has actually forced the nation of Argentina into a financial default. He's called the vulture for a good reason, not because he gives out the nice candy at Halloween. He's called the vulture because he takes down nations when they're vulnerable. What he's demanded is that Argentina pay him $1.5 billion, or even $3 billion, for bonds that he paid $1 billion for. He doesn't want, what he's claiming is that Argentina is a deadbeat. They won't pay him the money owed. That's not true. They will pay him every dime owed. Him is a 4,000% profit. And they're running ads that it's not the billionaire GOP vulture that's trying to suck the blood of Argentina. Rather, they're saying, oh, it's a bunch of poor Argentines who aren't getting their money. That's not true. There's nothing. Argentines have all gotten their money. They can all get their money. It's purely.
I mean, they show some Hispanic old woman who's babbling in Spanish. I can't. And then some old guy. And then they translate. I need. This is my life savings. They say these people are vultures.
What are they doing speculating in junk bonds? But
Yeah.
The Argentine, if you're Argentine, you want to be paid in Argentine pesos, you get everything you want.
Right.
So I don't know who these people are, because this literally, their claim is complete nonsense. It doesn't exist. It's
amazing.
Thank you
for clarifying that for me. And I'm guessing that probably the ultimate decision is going to be made by a federal judge who works out of or lives in Washington, D.C., and these ads are, there's saturation in the D.C. market. I live here in D.C. I'm guessing they're really spending all this money, or Paul Singer is really spending all this money, or whoever is, just to get one judge.
It is Paul Singer, the vulture, because the funding group is called AFPA, which is a front organization that he funds. We've investigated this at BBC to a fair thee well. Those who don't know me, I'm a BBC television reporter, and we've investigated these connections of Singer. He's the money, the vulture billionaire, GOP daddy Warbucks, is behind these ads. He's so concerned about the poor people of Argentina, and why did he force the nation of Argentina this week into a default? Do you have any idea what that's doing to the average Argentine? That's not in the ad. Is it?
No.
That's not in the ads. All the people that are losing their jobs and the destruction in Argentina because of this vulture. Even George Soros is upset. George Soros just attacked the Singer the Vulture today and is saying, what is it?
Yeah.
When George Soros calls you a financial vulture and a financial terrorist, you've got to be a pretty bad dude.
Yeah. Okay, so we got 4 minutes left, Greg. Let's talk about the real reason why 2,000 plus people died during Hurricane Katrina.
This week is the 9th anniversary. I did an investigation for British and European television. Here's what I found. Katrina went 35 miles east of the city. It's not, don't blame Mother Nature. The drowning of New Orleans was not an act of God. It was an act of Exxon, an act of Chevron, and big oil.
And not because they're causing global warming.
Well, it's how it, where global warming begins. What happened is that the oil companies removed 14,688 square miles of wetlands. Basically, they dug up the Louisiana-Mississippi Delta to get at the oil. First, they drill the oil, they drag in the barges, they run pipes, they run canals, and basically they've marched the Gulf of Mexico right up to the city gates of New Orleans, the levees. And oh, and then obviously, so in fact, one of the canals called the Go Canal is known as by hurricane experts as the Hurricane Highway. Basically, the oil companies took away 100 miles of protective mangrove, of protective wetlands. It used to be that if a hurricane or a storm had was heading towards New Orleans, basically that storm had to cross over a 100-mile carpet of trees and basically needles stopping it from marching into New Orleans. The oil company literally sank it. Louisiana is a lot smaller state than it was during the Civil War.
Now, they did this, what, so that they could build roads out and get easy access to the Gulf Coast for their drilling equipment?
Part of it was go straight to Gulf Coast, but most of it is just dragging barges, drilling equipment, channeling in pipes, barge channels.
So is this intentional, or is this the side effect of just overuse of the area?
Well, it's the overuse. It's all oil. And the thing is that those beautiful bayous that you see in the postcards are mostly actually kind of the scars. It used to be, by the way, Louisiana Delta was prairie. It's where most of the cattle ranching in America was done, believe it or not. Hmm. The oil companies came in and cut these channels, which we call bayous later. But then those have been sinking as they widen. They simply sink and bring in the Gulf of Mexico. So the Gulf of Mexico is close in now on the city of New Orleans. When Katrina hit, that hurricane highway, those bayous and canals, just became an escalator for Katrina's water surge to overtop the levees of the city. And Ivor Van Heerden, I mention his name because he's like probably the number one hurricane expert in America. He says, if it weren't for the oil companies destroying the wetland, Katrina would have been a storm of no note. We would have never even heard of it.
Wow.
There's no way that it would have overtopped those levees without the destruction by big oil of the wetlands. And when he said that, he not only lost his job, but the state of Louisiana closed the LSU Hurricane Center. Can you imagine?
Whoa.
Louisiana.
They shut down the University Hurricane Center because the Hurricane Center said the oil companies are bad guys?
The hurricane experts blamed Katrina on the oil companies, so they shut down the centers. Chevron gave the university a $300,000 check, and they opened up a new center called the Wetlands Center, which is promoting oil drilling in the wetlands, filled with professors that are literally approved by Chevron company executives.
Oh, geez. This is like the Koch brothers approving economics professors.
Yeah.
To teach libertarianism, this is a mind-boggling. Greg Palast, you can read all about it over at gregpalast.com. He's got a new op-ed about this. It's also his book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, and his new film, Vultures and Vote Rustlers. All great stuff. Greg, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much for dropping by.
You're the best.
Thanks, Greg.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's gregpalast.com, PALAST. We'll be right back. It's Viagra for your brain, Tom Hartman Program. Just don't tell Rush Limbaugh he'll want some. Richard in Victorville, California. Hey, Richard, what's up? What's on your mind? You wanted to talk about white privilege?
Well, I wanted to discuss white privilege real quick, and I also wanted to touch on one of your earlier callers that was complaining about Pelosi and all of the billionaires that are backing her.
Right.
You know, to people like that, I have one word, Alec.
Yeah.
Nowhere on the Democratic side does there exist an organization like Alec who specifically targets politicians from one side of the aisle and promises so much money in return for so much legislation. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, that quid pro quo is not explicit, but it's implicit, certainly. Yes, you're right.
And my thing, you know, to really expose that, I would love to see somebody do a study where they list the members of ALEC and how much money annually they put into that organization and what that organization spends per politician for what they want.
Right.
I'm sure that kind of documentation would be mind-blowing to everybody.
And then I would ask, how much additional profit have those same corporations made as a consequence of legislation passed by ALEC? And I would bet that their return on investment ranges from a low of 100 to 1 to a high of probably several tens of thousands of 1 to 1.
Yeah, well, and a study like that would probably be proof enough that this is basically racketeering.
That's right.
But that's an argument for another day. On the white privilege thing, you know, I'm a white guy. I grew up in Southern California in the L.A. area, working class family, working class neighborhood. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have been in situations as I grew up where a lot of my friends were African Americans, Hispanic, Asian, stuff like that. I've been out like on a Friday night with friends of mine when I was in high school, where I'm the only white kid in a crowd of like maybe 8 or 9 guys, and we're all on our way to like a house party or, you know, a football game or something. We're walking down the street and LAPD swoops up, and all of a sudden you've got cars blocking us, guns drawn, lights flashing, and they're segregating me from the rest of the crowd. And they're asking me, am I okay? You know, where were these guys taking you? You know, did they have weapons? Everybody else is up against the wall except for me. And then when I explain to them, look, these are my friends. We're on our way to go to a party, or we're on our way, you know, my buddy's mom is celebrating her birthday and we've all been invited over to. The moment I open my mouth and explain that I'm not a victim of a crime, I now find myself up against the wall with everyone else.
Right, because the crime now is you're friends with black guys.
Exactly. And for all of my fellow white people in this country who have never experienced this type of thing, you have no clue
right. How
privileged you really are.
Yeah.
In this country. And a quick note, Tom, on your last guest, with Louisiana. I lived in Louisiana for 8 years during the 80s, from 81 to 89. The whole time I lived there was always conversation and speculation how the oil companies could not wait to actually start drilling within the city limits of New Orleans because of how much oil they speculate is underground there. And the Ninth Ward area, most of the area that was destroyed and is still a ghost town today, lies right up against Lake Pontchartrain, which, if you've ever been there, you go out across Lake Pontchartrain, it's a sea of drilling rigs.
Mm-hmm.
These guys would love to start drilling on dry land in the city of New Orleans if they can. And there's, I've been there recently. There are entire, like, square blocks, neighborhoods that not a soul lives there anymore, and these used to be thriving communities. They have not recovered. The government has sold the land to the oil companies. It's all fenced off, and they're just waiting for enough people to continue to leave so they can start putting drilling rigs on dry land in the city of New Orleans.
I believe it. They're waiting for what Henry Kissinger called a decent interval.
Yeah, and I mean, the only thing that's ever stopped him is because of how historic a city New Orleans is.
Yeah.
They'll never get their feet down in the uptown New Orleans area or out on the west side in Metairie or over in Gretna on the West Bank, that kind of stuff. But the area, the 7th Ward, the 9th Ward, out in New Orleans East, all the areas to kind of back up against the industrial canals and Lake Pontchartrain, they're prime targets. And these were where most of the people of color and the poorer part of town was.
Right. It seems that, I mean, if you look at these piles of pet coke, which is the fly, is basically the ash from burning tar sands oil, and it still has some small burnable fraction in it. So, you know, we ship this stuff to China and they actually burn it. It's incredibly toxic. There are giant mountains of this stuff in Chicago and Detroit from the refineries, and they put them near the black areas, and the wind blows and it carries it into the African American areas. And so basically, if you can't put a toxic waste site there, put a drilling rig there. And this is the devaluing of black life in America.
Sounds like genocide to me.
Well, it's genocide with a friendly face and by a slightly different name. I think that we can just call it good old-fashioned racism, institutional racism. Richard, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing a fascinating story with us. I hope the white folks listening get this. I could tell some stories from my own life, but they involve family members, and I don't have their permission, so I won't. But anyway. Enough of that. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out greenworldrising.org. We've got a new video up. It's only 8 minutes. It's amazing. You're going to love it. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes past the hour. It's the True People's Media, Tom Hartman Program. And Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, you wanted to talk about the farm bill?
Well, yesterday I tried to call in and didn't make it. But you were talking to the guy who was going to have a program later on in the evening about the pollution and carbon and things. And I did not know if you were aware that when they were debating the agricultural bill, it's a five-year, $2.5 trillion five-year agricultural bill. The congresswoman from North Carolina had an amendment to limit the EPA's oversight of agricultural runoff. The same type of thing was done with the energy bill. And the energy bill was also being used to move the Army Corps of Engineers from the executive branch to the legislative branch because there's a $2.5 trillion trust fund for the Army Corps of Engineers. And they did not want the EPA to be able to monitor what the Army Corps of Engineers does when they widen the Monongahela, the Ohio, and put in new dams and new locks to move these huge cargo ships for coal. And I wasn't sure if you were aware that this was going on.
I was not. Thank you for that.
Any
recommendations for sources or possible guests on this topic? Where'd you read this?
Well, Danielle was looking it up, and she says she hasn't found it yet.
Okay.
But these bills are essentially what I call a war on the EPA, trying to restrict what the EPA can do. Right now they cannot even monitor these chemical containers above ground like the one in West Virginia that leaked.
Right.
And we do not even have a water treatment plant that removes chemicals from water. They only move biologicals. But with a water problem in Ohio, you can't even treat that mess. And that's probably from agricultural runoff, all of the nitrogens and the phosphates that go down the rivers. And as they continue with these mega farms and they overspray the fertilizers, the weed killers, and the insecticides, this is having a detrimental impact on the environment. And I don't think most people are aware of it. I personally believe that when they first started this genetic engineering stuff in the 80s and they were spraying this Roundup on the food, I personally believe that this is one of the things that has led to an increase in autism, the stuff moving into the food supply. Mm-hmm. And when they continue to contaminate our food supply and they contaminate our water supply, where are we supposed to live?
Right. Damn good question. We're seeing down in Central America, too, that it may have something to do with the explosion of kidney disease that we've seen in the United States over the last few decades. dialysis centers and things like that. You know, it's killing agricultural workers by destroying their kidneys. Norma, thank you for sharing that. We will we'll do a little more digging on it and see what we can find out. If you find anything, post it over on the daily blog over at tomhartman.com, okay?
Yeah. Do you remember when Brazil sued Dow Chemical for killing the banana workers?
No, I don't.
That was the judgment, I think, was in 2009, $500 million, because they oversprayed insecticides.
Yeah, okay. I'll look that up, too. Norma, thank you. Thank you for being on this, and thank you for sharing the information with us. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom.
Check in on your neighbor?
I have an idea. Kind of goes like this. Contact your neighbor program. It's very simple. The guy that lives across the street and the guy that lives off to your side, you know, go over and say, you know, how you doing? Are you registered to vote? You know,
right.
And if the person says, yeah, I am registered, well, that's fine. But if the person says, no, I'm not registered, you know, can I help you get registered? I'd like to see you vote, you know.
Now, Howard, how do you help somebody get registered?
How do you help somebody get registered if they don't have the means of transportation to get registered? You could help them in that way.
Right.
You know. And
you give them a ride to the voter registration place. You need to know where that voter registration place is. You might want to have the voter registration forms with you. You can pick them up here in D.C. You pick them up at the DMV. I'm not sure where else you pick them up.
My idea, Tom, is maybe something that you'd be interested in and talk about on your program, because, you know, that's a real simple thing to do, and you don't have to have a lot of people out canvassing the neighborhoods and using their car and their gasoline.
Right.
Just simple your own neighborhood.
Yeah,
know?
And the voter registration forms are printed at the expense of the government. They're free. You can you know, go to your DMV and pick up a handful of them, and they have with them the instructions, so you can see. Here in D.C., for example, when I registered to vote, I had to show – well, actually, I got my driver's license registered to vote at the same time. So I had to show my birth certificate. I had to show two forms of proof that I actually am a resident of the District of Columbia. I had to show another form of ID to prove that I am who I am, which was my my Oregon driver's license. And there was one other thing that I had to show. I went back three times. You know, I had to go back three times because each time I was missing something. And, you know, had I had that form to begin with and sat down and looked it over carefully and or if somebody had been walking me through it, it might have been a lot easier. And if I'm not a, you know, I'm no dummy, you know, and if it takes me three trips to the DMV to get it right, you know, it's frankly, there's something wrong. But anyway, Howard, thank you. Excellent suggestion. Take some responsibility for your neighbors getting involved. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about Bill O'Reilly?
Absolutely, and about white privilege as well. Guys like Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, and those characters, they're worse than the racists that they peddle the poison to. Because I guarantee you, Bill O'Reilly understands white privilege. He's an intelligent man. He understands this. But he knows that his base, his audience, don't. So he plays the idiot. He plays, Rush Limbaugh does the same thing. You know, they play the dumbed-down person that never heard of white privilege and they don't understand what it is. And they absolutely know what it is, but they're playing to their base. So we won't let him off the hook that easily.
Yeah.
By saying maybe he don't understand. Yes, he does. He does. Trust me. They all do. They just, you know, they end up making money and that's what they do. And they know that their core base don't understand it.
I'm inclined to agree with you, Carl.
Yeah, and to your point that most white people, you would think that 75% of white people don't understand white privilege because it's like breathing. You know, it's like a fish in water. Fish don't understand it's in water, just know that it is.
And 75% of white people don't have you know, any kind of personal or intimate contact with even one single black person.
Right. So they don't understand the privilege that they get. That's why they're so shocked and upset when finally a militarized police force is in their neighborhood. When they and it's funny whenever I hear middle class white people call in and even upper middle class and affluent neighborhoods, when they call in the talk shows and they complain about police, and I laugh because I'm thinking, you know, well, black people have been telling you about police forever. You're just figuring it out because you lived in your white privileged bubble. And an analogy that I love to use, and this kind of shakes people up when I say this, I don't believe George Washington to be a good guy. And in fact, I think him to be a very, very bad guy. I think that most of the founding fathers of our country were bad people, very bad individuals, and that shocks white people because they've been taught their whole life that these were the greatest people of all times. And I tell them, you know, from my perspective, they owned other people. And even if they didn't, even if the ones that didn't own other human beings, they didn't speak out. It took another 100 years of our country existence to finally say, you know what, maybe the slavery thing is not such a good thing, and maybe we should live by what we wrote down 100 years ago, that all men are created equal. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shakes white people up when I tell them that I don't know why in the hell we put those men up on a pedestal. They were horrible, horrible people. And not to say that the concept of America is a horrible thing. I mean, it's probably one of the most weirdest, greatest experiments ever in history. Just to think that you could take a continent full of immigrants, you know, start out on the East Coast and spread all the way through, and the damn thing kind of works. And go figure. You probably never see anything like this again in history, and probably never seen anything like this in history before. But that don't mean that just because they started something like this, that they weren't bad, bad people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you nailed it, Carl. Thanks a lot for the call. Gloria, actually, you've got a story to tell. I want to give you a little more time to tell that. So I'm going to hold until after the break, and cause we just have 45 seconds here, until we're going to hit a break. But the point, it was Carl, right? The point that Carl was making, I think, is a really well said and principled point. I find it hard to believe, although not impossible to believe, that a white guy at the pinnacle of his success in conservative media, somebody like, for example, Bill O'Reilly, who last night on television denied that there was such a thing as white privilege, that I find it hard to believe that Bill O'Reilly would believe that, although, you know, I forget who came up with this saying, but, you know, never underestimate the impact of a paycheck on a person's opinions. There may be an element of that. There may be an element of, you know, hey, he just always hung out with white people. There may be an element of, well, I don't know. Here, am I making excuses for him? It sounds like. So maybe I should just go with Carl and say he's got it. He's got it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Here, check out GreenWorldRising.org, too. If you have any thoughts on, you know, carbon taxes and putting a price on carbon, I'd love to hear them. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gloria in Country Club Hills, Illinois. Boy, that's a waspy-sounding place to live, Gloria. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoy it. I listen to you all the time. I have been for years. The reason I called, I wasn't too well last week, but you know, I was talking about the justice system because of this Missouri thing.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, I was raised to respect the police and all this stuff when I was a kid, and I grew up thinking everything was fine. And I served on a jury, a grand jury, in the 80s, the mid-80s. And I was a foreman there. And we were there for 4 weeks. And you could count the whites that were there, you know, to go to be indicted on one hand.
It was all black.
But the young blacks, the prosecutors would come in, and they would say that they did something, and they were charging them as adults, and they would be like 12, 13, 14, whatever. And I would ask them, they got frustrated with me, because by the time they got through talking about, you know, what the kid had did, and I would ask them, well, how old did you say they were? And they would get really upset with me. And then they had two young girls that were at the shopping mall, and they said that they were shoplifting. And then they said that they had drugs. And I asked them, I said, well, what kind of drugs? And they said, well, one had codeine tablets. Well, I had a lot of dental problems growing up, and I would get codeine tablets for it. And I asked them, well, were they prescription drugs? And got to fumbling and carrying on. Well, yeah, you know. And a lot of times when they would go for, after the prosecutors would get through, they would, you know, say true bill or no bill. And the people would be sitting there with the newspapers and the crossword puzzles and whatever, and all their hands would go up, you know, and they'd stand on the trial. And after a while, I told them, I said, well, look, you know, this might be these kids' last chance, you know, to have some kind of justice. You need to listen to what's going on. And afterwards, they would start listening, and they didn't send as many Truvilles as they had been. Yeah. And at first, at the end of the day, we were there like 4 weeks. End of the day, I would have to take the paperwork into the office where all these prosecutors were. Daly was a K-State's attorney at the time in Chicago. And at first, they would, you know, have me go all the way up to the through the room to a desk in the front, and I'd leave my papers. But after a while, after I started questioning, the people started questioning, they would meet me at the door, snatch the papers out of my hand, and slam the door in my face. So it was
don't rock
it was
the
an experience because I never knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And I remember my son, he was in high school, and one day we saw some police at somebody's car, and he was in the car with us, and he said to me and my husband, I hate police with this venom. And I said, what? And that was before I went on the grand jury. And he said, I said, why would you say that? And he said, because every day we get out of school, the police cars pull up, they throw us up against the cars, pat us down, and if somebody hit them upside the head, and I was shocked. But then when I went on a grand jury, I could understand what he was talking about.
Yeah, amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, the stories of America that were just now, the stories of the oppressed, the underclass of America, both white and black, and Hispanic and right across the board, these stories have been largely held by the people to whom they have happened for centuries, frankly. And now I think some of this is starting to get out, which is a good thing. These conversations are starting to happen. Gloria, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Ken in Inwood, West Virginia. Hey, Ken, you talked to a couple teabaggers?
Yeah. They have. There were two guys in front of one of the local gas stations, and they had all these little signs of Peter Baum, and they're waving people in, you know, come sign this documentation. You know, and I always love debate, not confrontation, but I like debate. So I was thinking about, because they were there the next day, and I was like, well, maybe I should get some of my own facts. And I decided to say, you know what, I don't think that's going to work, because these guys are just going to go, these are my facts, and you're just a left-wing liberal. You got yours from whoever else, and then, you know, mine's are right, yours are wrong.
Right.
So I figured I decided to do something else. I decided to challenge their logic. And I came to them and I said, well, who are you supporting for the West Virginia Senate? Are you going to support Natalie Tennant or Shelley Moore Capito? And they said, well, Shelley Moore Capito. And I said, well, since you have your astute documentation that's stating that Obama did these crimes, then why is she not presenting a bill to get Boehner to impeach Obama? I mean, if this is dead straight to the facts, then if she's not doing it, then she must support Obama. And you see they started getting, you know, kind of mad because I'm starting to, you know, they're starting to think about it a little bit.
Mm.
And then they go back to, well, and they have to sign with Obama, President Obama, with a Hitler mustache.
Right.
Well, he's going to, you know, the left-wing liberals and Obama's going to take our guns, and he, you know, just like Hitler did, you know, back in the day. I said, oh, okay. So if you're talking about Hitler back in the day, then why isn't Obama lining up all these people that are against him and all these right-wing Fox News pundits that are saying bad things about him and getting him out of the way. What about the first 2 years when Obama had, a majority in Congress? Then why did he just get rid of guns? You know, the same way that the Republicans didn't get rid of abortion because there's no way of doing it.
Right.
And, I just wish people would start challenging them more, like Bernie Sanders, and the Democratic side, and start challenging them that way instead of, because you can throw facts and maybe ignore it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Ken, good on you for engaging the other side. Maybe you changed a mind or two. Who knows? Thanks so much for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back tomorrow. Boy, the week is really rolling along. It's Wednesday already. Holy cow, and there's a holiday coming this weekend. Anyhow, yeah, summer's over. Polar vortex is here. Don't forget, our constitutionally limited representative Democratic Republic does not function if we don't participate. There's an election coming up in November. Make sure you're registered to vote. Make sure your friends are. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.